I'm speaking with Michael Brennus, lecturer in history at Yale University and author of the forthcoming book, For Might and Right, Cold War Defense Spending and the Remaking of American Democracy. His work on American foreign policy, political history, and political economy appears often in publications like The Nation, Politico, Boston Review, Foreign Policy, and the Chronicle of Higher Ed. And a recent piece in The New Republic that we're talking about today, and we'll link to it on the Old Mole webpage, what the Defund the Police movement can learn from the six-decade effort to radically demilitarize U.S. foreign policy. Welcome to KABU, Michael Brennus.
Oh, thanks, Claire. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
As we watch this amazing and massive social movement for racial justice unfold in cities across the country, which is dramatically changing the conversation about how public dollars are spent on policing, you and historian Tim Keogh have reminded us that anti-war activists have long struggled to dismantle another devastating form of state violence, the U.S. national security state. Yet we've seen spending for the military-industrial complex continue to grow in the past six decades. What have been the enormous challenges facing activists who have sought to convert military dollars into more socially productive uses such as housing, healthcare, and education?
Well, I think there are a couple. The first is sort of the larger overarching ideology that keeps a massive, you know, defense industry churning in the United States. That is, first, you know, of course, for you know, almost 60 years, the Cold War. You know, you have essentially the United States fighting on behalf of the world as it sees itself doing and being the protector of democracy. And there's a choice that's made in you know, the post-war years to fight that Cold War with massive military power. And that ideology, you know, that sort of the Cold War anti-communism that keeps, you know, foreign policy or American foreign policy fighting that larger fight for democracy, you know, ebbs and flows, but ultimately it's still very much intact. And I think once the Cold War ends, that anti-communism goes away, but there's still a overarching threat, at least by some people perceive, or threats that are perceived by many in the national security establishment. And that I think is some of the, one of the legacies of the Cold War. And that ideology, I think, sort of is still very much here with us. And we can talk about that perhaps if you want. But I think that's one important factor. And the other is the political economy of the national security state, which employs, you know, thousands, if not millions of people across the country. And that has sort of essentially tethered people to this political economy that, you know, in many ways they don't necessarily want to be attached to it, but it often has provided throughout its history good paying unionized jobs that have allowed people to buy good homes in suburban neighborhoods. And I think, you know, there's been overall a lack of interest in giving those up, particularly after the 1970s and 80s, when you start seeing recessions that hit American workers, and particularly working class, but American workers overall quite hard. And I think those two challenges together, working in tandem, kind of present activists with these, you know, both, you know, waging a war on two fronts, essentially, fighting this ideology of anti-communism, trying to challenge that, and also trying to get people to envision what a peacetime workforce would look like.
And just even introducing that conversation about conversion has been difficult, given this kind of ideology.
Correct.
And political economy. Well, you mentioned that the 70s and 80s. I mean, what about at the end of the Vietnam War and the end of the Cold War, mm-hmm. by the 1990s? I mean, can we learn mm-hmm. anything about some of those more hopeful moments when conversion advocates actually, and anti-war activists actually made some headway in Congress, mm-hmm. you know, thinking about converting those military dollars to something more useful?
Yeah, sure. I think there are a couple lessons. I think after the Vietnam War, and even during the Vietnam War in the late 60s and early 70s, there was a big public discourse about the military-industrial complex, really, that one hadn't seen since the early 60s. And in 1961, when Dwight Eisenhower, of course, made his famous farewell address, when he talked about the military-industrial complex. By the late 60s, when Vietnam is overwhelmingly a quagmire, it's evident to the American public that this is a war that can't be won, and they're trying to figure out how this war kept on going and why it keeps going. There's this critique within the public, but also among intellectuals and scientists about, you know, what this national security state has done to further war, or at least to try not to, or to try not to discontinue Americans or disconnect Americans from war. And that really, as I say in my book that's coming out, that moment gets shunted aside, or really, you know, overcome by sort of larger economic concerns that are overwhelming Americans at the time. Again, as I talked about, so there's recession in the 1970s when the defense industry is really, and that is true, it's cut by and large, it's experiencing budget cuts in the late 60s and early 70s. And the defense industry, the argument that they make now is that, well, we're still fighting a Vietnam War, and the Vietnam War doesn't end until 1975, and we still need to give Americans jobs. That's something that obviously people can grab hold of in that moment. And I think in the going forward into the 80s and 90s, you start to see a similar phenomenon, since that there is this, you know, moment, you know, called the end of history, so-called end of history, but this idea that we don't need to fight this war anymore. The Cold War is over. This is an opportunity for activists who've been fighting this long fight to mobilize on behalf of defense conversion. And what you see is also in the early 1990s is a recession, where Bill Clinton takes office and it's a recession, and he is more concerned arguably about cutting taxes or benefiting Wall Street. You know, his economic advisors say defense conversion isn't a big deal. You don't need to worry about it. Let's focus on Wall Street and bring back the economy that way. And so this moment also gets overshadowed by these larger economic concerns. And there is quite a lot of activism that's being done in local communities to try to bring this wartime economy into a peacetime footing. And that all gets, unfortunately, defeated.
Well, this is also a time that, as you write, that the militarization of the police is accelerated.
You know, right.
That there's this feedback loop where the lessons learned in counterinsurgent operations to subjugate colonized populations inform these modern methods of racialized policing in U.S. Mm-hmm. cities. So how does this militarization of the police accelerate at this time in the 90s?
Well, you have, you know, this is, as we say in the piece, as Tim Q and I say in the piece, this is a direct outcome of the failure of conversion in the early 90s. And the 1033 program is created in the late 1970s, 1997, I believe, is the year when the 1033 program is created. And that allows police departments to purchase relatively cheaply military equipment from the Department of Defense. And this is when you start to see the explosion of policing in the United States. This is not, I mean, this has a long history, of course, going back to, the war on poverty in the 60s. And there's been some good work done on this by Elizabeth Hinton and Stuart Schrader, who wrote a great book called Badges Without Borders, which is on the role of counterinsurgency and how it shaped policing in the United States. But this sort of the militarization of the police, as we think of it today, and as we saw in recent weeks, that's really an outcome of the late 1990s. And again, sort of the decision by members of the Clinton administration to not focus on it, to deal with other things, getting the economy going again through finance and allowing the surplus equipment to filter into local communities where it's now being used on, or to this day, protesters who are marching and mobilizing against police brutality.
And as you say, it sounds like this idea of providing secure employment through state violence links both military and policing budgets, where each consume, you know, maybe 40% of federal and municipal budgets. And it's not just the workers and their unions preventing conversion, but there's a lot of popular support for diverting public spending to policies like
right.
the Green New Deal and universal health care, or at the federal mm-hmm. level for diplomacy rather than war spending. So how do we translate this popular will into changed policy?
It's a great question. I mean, I I think for where I stand, at least my perspective, is that we need to attack the political economy of both policing and defense and the interrelationship between the two. And obviously this starts with some reforms. At least, you know, there's been calls by some congressional officials to get rid of the 1033 program. That's a great step, right? There's been other attempts to at least figure out how this happened, the militarization of the police happened, and how it's tied to defense spending among some elected officials. But I think the job for activists and those, and I think they are doing this work, is to really think about how we can propose an alternative program, a concrete alternative program that can get on the agenda of congressional officials, you know, state governments as well, to put forward a specific plan or program about how we can, you know, demilitarize policing, and thinking about, therefore, where this feeds back into foreign policy. And so, you know, from where I stand, and I think as you're implying, these aren't separate projects. It's the demilitarization of police and demilitarization of foreign policy and separate projects, but they're linked together. And I think that's kind of the work that has to be done for activists now, is thinking about what ways can we attack these two forces as they work simultaneously together or interrelated in the ways that we've seen play out over the past few weeks, and how could we figure out the best way forward to getting people off, you know, or less addicted to policing and security. And I think that's a challenge, and I'm not an activist, so I'm not the best person to answer that question. So, but I think that's where I would put my emphasis going forward.
Well, Mike, finally, in our last minute or so here, what are there other lessons from this history of anti-war activism trying to demilitarize the federal budget that might help us understand what needs to happen in terms of, you know, reinvigorating a program for defense conversion that can also be incorporated into this project to defund the police?
I think, you know, as we say in the piece, I think, you know, there needs to be, you know, mass politics, you know, mass democratic mobilization on the part of Americans, you know, is key to this. I think, you know, it's times when defense conversion has made inroads, or where there's almost, you know, a moment where defense conversion looks like it's going to happen in certain communities. It's been when there's coordinated efforts by, you know, members in that community, but also state officials, and even members of the defense industry who realize this is not a profitable industry anymore, which is also part of this story. But this is few and far between, but this does happen. You know, so you know, you need this interrelationship and these networks, democratic networks, to sort of mobilize on behalf of this moment and form coalitions that can create lasting change. And I think, you know, the protests are the start of this, right? Where the protests are, you see mass democratic action, you know, on behalf of not just reform, but defunding. And this is a great catalytic moment, I think, for activists. And the next step, I think, is to sort of figure out how we expand our coalitions, or how, you know, the defund movement expands coalitions and starts working with state and federal officials to get specific laws passed and programs passed that can really see defense conversion on a large scale be implemented.
It does seem like a really great moment for reimagining public spending and public priorities that many people are beginning to get. So here's hoping that kind of broader linkage and activism takes place in the near future. Michael Brennan, thanks so much for joining us today on KBOO's Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thanks, Lori. It was a pleasure.
Generals gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction. In the fields of bodies burning, as war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah.